A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a deep dive into tradecraft. He's pointing to reports that Israel built a covert drone base and pre-positioned explosive drones deep inside Iran, near Tehran, and used them to destroy surface-to-surface missile launchers in the opening hours of the June 13th strikes. Iranian authorities later said they dismantled the Mossad drone workshop near Tehran. The question isn't about the air war or the politics, it's about logistics. How do you smuggle attack drones into one of the most heavily surveilled countries on Earth, conceal them until the moment, and launch them from inside the perimeter?
This is the kind of thing where the operational details are more fascinating than the strike itself. The strike is the headline. The logistics are the whole story.
Because the headline is, drones hit missile launchers near Tehran, and the natural assumption is they came from outside, over the border from Azerbaijan or Iraq or wherever. But the claim here, and this is what's been reported by Israeli officials, is that these drones were already inside. They were assembled there, stored there, and launched from inside Iran. That's a fundamentally different problem.
And the reporting on this is still fragmentary. We should be clear about what's confirmed versus what's inferred. What we know from Israeli sources is that during Operation Rising Lion on June 13, 2025, a wave of drone strikes hit Iranian surface-to-surface missile launchers and air defense nodes in the opening hours. What's been claimed is that some of those drones were launched from inside Iranian territory, not from outside. Iranian authorities subsequently announced they'd uncovered and dismantled what they called a Mossad drone workshop near Tehran. So both sides are pointing at the same phenomenon from different angles.
They're confirming each other by accident.
The Iranians are saying, we found their workshop. And the Israelis are basically saying, yeah, and we used it first. So let's walk through the three phases. Smuggling, concealment, activation. Start with smuggling. How do you get attack drones and precision weapons into Iran?
The short answer is, you don't. You don't smuggle drones. You smuggle components that become drones later. That's the core insight.
And this is the modern descendant of a very old smuggling logic. If you try to move a completed weapon system across a border, you're moving something that looks like a weapon. It has a shape, a signature, a heat profile. But if you break it down into 50 or 100 innocuous components, circuit boards, motors, carbon fiber tubes, batteries, servo actuators, none of those things individually is a weapon. They're commercial electronics, industrial parts, hobbyist supplies. They pass through customs because they don't trigger any red flags.
Smuggle the parts, not the weapon. It's the IKEA approach to covert operations.
I hate how well that works as an analogy. You're shipping flat pack death, assembly required, and the key enabler here is the drone revolution itself. 10 or 15 years ago, an attack drone with a meaningful payload was a military system. Large, recognizable, purpose-built. Today, the components for a capable loitering munition overlap heavily with commercial drone racing parts, agricultural sprayer components, industrial inspection platforms. The supply chain is dual-use by default.
Walk me through what that looks like in practice. Say you're moving components for 30 or 40 attack drones. What are you actually shipping?
Let's think about what an explosive drone needs. You need airframe components. Fuselage sections, wing spars, control surfaces. These can be carbon fiber or fiberglass, machined to look like structural parts for industrial equipment. You need a power plant, electric motors, propellers, speed controllers. These are off the shelf for any high-end commercial drone. You need guidance and control, GPS modules, inertial measurement units, flight controllers, antennas. All commercially available, all small, all dual use. You need a warhead, and this is the trickiest part. Plus a fuse mechanism. And you need batteries, wiring, connectors, servos.
The warhead is the hard part.
The warhead is always the hard part. But even there, the precursors for explosives can be disguised as industrial chemicals. Ammonium nitrate is fertilizer. Hydrogen peroxide in certain concentrations is a bleaching agent. and the shaped charge liners or fragmentation sleeves that turn a blob of explosive into an armor-piercing or anti-personnel weapon. Those can be machined from copper or steel and described as plumbing fittings or industrial bushings.
Of course they can.
Customs inspection is not a forensic laboratory. A shipping container goes through a port, it gets an x-ray scan at best, maybe a physical inspection of a small percentage of containers. If your manifest says industrial pump components, and the x-ray shows shapes consistent with industrial pump components, and the shipping company is a real registered business with a history of moving industrial pump components, you're probably getting through. The system is designed for volume, not for detecting a sophisticated adversary who spent years building cover.
The volume is the point. Millions of containers move through Iranian ports every year. Bandar Abbas alone handles something like 2.5 million TEUs annually. You're not hiding a needle in a haystack. You're hiding a needle in a needle factory.
And the reporting suggests this was done over months or years. You don't ship everything at once. You drip feed components through multiple channels, different ports, different freight companies, different time windows. One shipment brings in carbon fiber tubes described as replacement parts for agricultural irrigation booms. Another brings in flight controllers packed inside shipments of legitimate electronics. Another brings in motor assemblies mixed in with HVAC repair parts. No single shipment looks like a weapon system because no single shipment is a weapon system.
You've got this distributed smuggling network. What about the front companies? Because you can't just ship things to a P.O. box and hope for the best.
No, you need real commercial entities with real addresses, real employees, real business activities. The classic model, and this has been used in operations going back decades, is to establish or acquire a small legitimate business that actually does the thing it claims to do. An electronics importer that really does import electronics, and 95% of its shipments are legitimate. The other 5% are your components. The business has a warehouse, it has staff who don't know what's really happening, it has tax records and utility bills. It looks normal because it mostly is normal.
The mostly legitimate business is the unsung hero of espionage logistics.
It really is. And in the Iranian context, you've got additional layers. There are existing smuggling networks that move consumer goods, sanctioned electronics, luxury items. These networks already know how to bribe customs officials, how to route shipments through third countries, how to falsify paperwork. The drone components can piggyback on infrastructure that already exists for moving iPhones and PlayStations into a sanctioned economy.
Because Iran is under sanctions, has been for years, so there's an entire parallel economy of smuggling that's just... it's the plumbing of the Iranian import sector, and you can tap into it.
The sanctions paradoxically help you here. When legitimate channels are restricted, the alternative channels become more developed, more sophisticated, and less scrutinized per unit because the volume of smuggled goods is so high. Customs officials are looking for undeclared consumer goods to assess duties, or for sanctioned military equipment that looks like military equipment. They're not looking for carbon fiber tubes in a shipment of carbon fiber tubes.
Phase 1, smuggling, is about patience, compartmentalization, and hiding in plain sight inside legitimate commercial flows. What about Phase 2? The components are inside Iran. Now you have to store them, assemble them, and keep them hidden until activation.
This is where the safe house network comes in. The reporting mentions a drone workshop near Tehran. Iranian authorities said they dismantled it. That workshop was presumably where final assembly happened. But it's unlikely everything was stored in one place. You'd spread components across multiple locations so that even if one cache is discovered, you haven't lost the whole operation.
Like a distributed inventory system. Warehouse A has airframes. Warehouse B has motors. Warehouse C has warheads. Nobody who isn't supposed to know sees the full picture.
And the assembly site, the workshop, only receives components shortly before assembly. You don't want everything sitting in one location for months. The operational security principle is, minimize the time window during which discovery would be catastrophic.
The assembly phase is compressed. Components arrive, drones get built, they move to launch positions, and then they're activated. How long are we talking?
Probably days to weeks for assembly, depending on the number of drones and the complexity. These aren't Predator-class systems. We're talking about loitering munitions, maybe with a 2-meter wingspan, maybe a 20 or 30 kilogram all-up weight with a 10 kilogram warhead. A skilled technician can assemble something like that in a few hours if the components are designed for rapid assembly. Modular connectors, pre-wired harnesses, snap together airframe sections. You design for assembly speed because you know the assembly window is your vulnerability.
The engineering of the drone itself reflects the operational constraint. It's not just build a drone that works. It's build a drone that can be assembled in a rented warehouse by someone who may not be an aerospace engineer using hand tools in minimal time.
And that design philosophy, designed for clandestine assembly, is a fascinating constraint. You want foolproof alignment of critical components. You want wiring harnesses that can only be connected one way. You want pre-calibrated sensors so nobody has to run a test flight. You want the whole thing to go together like flat-pack furniture where the instructions are color-coded and the fasteners are captive so nothing gets lost.
The IKEA analogy again, Alan Key included.
Unironically, the design principles are similar. You're optimizing for assembly by non-specialists in non-ideal conditions. And that's a real engineering challenge when the thing also has to fly autonomously to a target, navigate potentially in GPS-denied conditions, and deliver a warhead accurately.
Now, the safe houses and the workshop, where are they? The claim is near Tehran.
The Iranian statement said the workshop was near Tehran. We don't have precise locations, and we probably won't for years. But there's a trade-off here between proximity and security. If you're launching drones with a limited range, say 30 to 50 kilometers, you need to be close to the targets. That means you're in the greater Tehran metropolitan area, which is heavily populated and heavily surveilled. The IRGC and the Ministry of Intelligence have extensive networks of informants and checkpoints. Operating a covert workshop in that environment is extremely high risk.
The flip side is that being close gives you a short flight time, less warning, less reaction time, less chance of interception. The drone is in the air for maybe 10 or 15 minutes instead of an hour crossing from outside the border.
And that's the trade-off. If you launch from outside Iran, you might need a drone with a 1,000-kilometer range, which means it's larger, more expensive, easier to detect on radar, and it's in the air long enough for air defenses to potentially respond. If you launch from 15 kilometers away, the drone is small, the flight time is minimal, and by the time anyone realizes what's happening, the warhead has already detonated.
Proximity is your stealth. You're not trying to evade radar. You're trying to make radar irrelevant because there's no time to react.
And this connects to the broader principle that this operation illustrates, the collapse of distance as a defense. For most of military history, distance was protection. If the enemy is 1,000 kilometers away, they need to cross that distance to hurt you, and you can see them coming. But if they can pre-position weapons inside your territory, distance is meaningless. Your interior is now the front line.
Which is terrifying from a defensive perspective. Iran has invested heavily in air defense and early warning systems oriented outward, looking for threats coming from outside. The entire architecture assumes the threat vector is external.
That assumption is exactly what this kind of operation exploits. You're not defeating the air defense system, you're making it irrelevant by originating the attack from inside the defended perimeter. The radar is looking at the border. The drone is already 10 kilometers from the target.
Let's talk about the people. Who's doing the assembly, the positioning, the launch? Because this isn't just a smuggling operation. It requires personnel on the ground inside Iran.
This is the most sensitive part and the least reported. The options range from locally recruited assets to infiltrated operatives. If you have a network of Iranian nationals working for you, for ideological reasons, for money, for leverage, they can provide the safe houses, the warehouse leases, the vehicle registrations. They can do the assembly, or at least provide the space where assembly happens. But the actual technical work of assembling combat drones and preparing them for launch probably requires trained personnel.
You're smuggling in people too.
Or you're training local assets outside the country and sending them back in. Or you're using third country nationals with clean travel documents, business travelers, technical consultants, people with legitimate reasons to be in Iran. The cover stories write themselves. You're a Turkish or Pakistani or Central Asian technician here to service industrial equipment. You enter legally, you do your real job during the day, and at night you're assembling drones in a warehouse.
The consultant who consults cover.
It's the same principle as the legitimate business. The cover is real. The person actually has the skills they claim to have, actually does the work they claim to do, and actually gets paid for it. The covert activity is layered on top of genuine professional activity.
How many people are we talking about?
For an operation of this scale, multiple launch sites, dozens of drones, you probably need at least a handful of technical personnel, plus a support network of drivers, safe house keepers, lookouts. Maybe 10 to 20 people who know what's really happening, plus a larger number of unwitting facilitators who think they're just renting a warehouse to a nice Turkish businessman.
The operational security of keeping that network intact for months or years, in a country with an aggressive counterintelligence apparatus, is staggering.
It's extraordinarily difficult. The Iranians have gotten very good at rolling up networks. They've caught Mossad operatives before. They've executed people for espionage. The fact that this network apparently remained intact long enough to execute the operation suggests extremely tight compartmentalization. Each cell knows only what it needs to know. The person renting the warehouse doesn't know what's being stored. The person assembling airframes doesn't know where the warheads are. The person programming GPS coordinates doesn't know the launch locations. If any one person is captured, they can only compromise their slice.
That's the "you can't betray what you don't know" principle.
And it's the only way to run an operation like this. Every person is a single point of failure for their piece, but nobody is a single point of failure for the whole operation.
Phase 3. Activation. The drones are assembled. They're at their launch positions. How do you launch them at the decisive moment, coordinated with the broader air campaign?
The claim is that the drone strikes hit in the opening hours of Operation Rising Lion, coordinated with the larger air campaign. That coordination is critical. If your internal drones hit first, they degrade air defenses and create confusion just as the external strike packages are inbound. The air defense operators are looking at threats from inside the country, their systems are taking hits, their command and control is disrupted, and then the main wave arrives from outside.
It's a 1-2 punch. The inside threat creates chaos that the outside threat exploits.
And the launch methods are worth understanding. These drones don't need runways. They can be launched from vehicle-mounted rails, essentially a pickup truck with a launch ramp in the back. Drive to the launch point, set up in minutes, launch, drive away. Or rooftop launch from a building you control. The drone itself might use a small rocket booster for initial acceleration, or a pneumatic catapult, or just a powerful electric motor with a folding propeller.
A guy in a truck pulls up in an industrial area 15 kilometers from a missile base, sets up a ramp, launches a drone, and drives off. Total time on site, maybe 5 minutes.
That's if he's being careful. The launch itself is nearly silent compared to a missile launch. No big thermal signature, no radar warning. By the time the drone appears on anyone's scope, it's already in its terminal phase. And, if it's flying low, which it would be, ground clutter masks it from radar until it's very close.
The launch vehicle just merges back into traffic. It's a truck. Tehran has millions of trucks.
And that's the final layer of concealment. The launch platform is not a military vehicle. It's a Toyota Hilux or a Kia Bongo with a tarp over the back. Before launch, it's just another commercial vehicle. After launch, it's just another commercial vehicle going somewhere else. There's nothing to identify it unless someone saw the launch happen and reported it immediately.
Which, in the chaos of the opening minutes of a major air campaign, is unlikely to result in a timely interception.
Even if someone reports it, what are you going to do? Scramble fighters to intercept a truck that launched a drone 10 minutes ago? The drone has already hit its target. The truck is gone. The entire engagement cycle is too fast for conventional response.
Let's talk about the targets. The reporting mentions surface-to-surface missile launches and air defense nodes.
Because those are the systems that pose the greatest threat to an incoming air campaign. If you're Israel and you're about to send strike packages into Iranian airspace, your biggest concern is Iranian ballistic missiles being launched to Israel in retaliation and Iranian air defenses shooting down your aircraft. If you can degrade both of those capabilities in the first hour, you fundamentally change the geometry of the conflict.
You're hitting them with drones launched from inside the country, which means the launches and air defense systems that are supposed to protect against external threats are themselves being hit from inside their own perimeter.
It's the ultimate reversal. The systems designed to keep threats out are being destroyed by threats that are already in. And that's the strategic message beyond the tactical effect. It says, your borders don't protect you. Your air defenses don't protect you. Your distance from Israel doesn't protect you. We can reach out and touch you anywhere, anytime, from any direction.
The psychological dimension of that is enormous. It's not just about the physical damage to the missile launchers. It's about demonstrating that the entire defensive architecture is built on a flawed assumption.
This connects to the broader evolution of warfare that cheap drones are driving. A loitering munition that costs maybe $50,000 can destroy a missile launcher that costs millions. But the smuggling and prepositioning dimension adds a new layer. It's not just that the weapon is cheap. It's that the weapon can be delivered to the target's doorstep months in advance by civilian logistics and activated at the moment of your choosing.
The supply chain is the weapon system.
The supply chain is the weapon system. The drone is just the payload at the end of a very long, very patient logistics pipeline.
Let's pull back and talk about what this means for the future. Because this isn't just an Iran-Israel story. The technique, smuggle components, assemble locally, launch from inside, is replicable.
It's extremely replicable, and that's what makes this significant beyond the specific operation. Any country with a developed commercial import sector is potentially vulnerable to this. The components are dual use. The expertise is widespread. The cost is low. The defensive countermeasures are, I'm not sure they even exist yet in a systematic way.
What would a countermeasure even look like? You can't x-ray every shipping container down to the component level. You can't track every warehouse lease in a major city. You can't surveil every truck.
It's a genuinely hard problem. You can improve human intelligence, infiltrate the networks, recruit informants, monitor suspicious commercial entities. The Iranians have had some success with that, which is presumably how they eventually found the workshop. But that's after the fact. Preventing the initial emplacement is much harder. You'd need a level of supply chain visibility that no country currently has.
The asymmetry is brutal. The attacker needs to succeed once, get the drones in, position them, launch them. The defender needs to succeed every time, across every possible entry point, for years.
The attacker can choose the time and place. The defender has to be lucky all the time. The attacker only has to be lucky once. It's the oldest asymmetry in warfare, but the enabling technology makes it cheaper and more accessible than ever before.
What about the Iranian claim that they dismantled the workshop? If they found it, doesn't that suggest the technique has a shelf life?
Sure, for that specific network. But the technique itself doesn't depend on any particular workshop. If they found one, it means the Iranians are getting better at counterintelligence. But it also means the Israelis got the strike off before the network was rolled up. The timing is everything. The workshop was discovered after the operation, not before. So from an operational perspective, it worked.
The counterintelligence success is post hoc. The damage was already done.
And for future operations, the adversary will adapt. Different smuggling routes, different cover methods, different assembly techniques. This is an arms race between smugglers and counterintelligence, and the smugglers have the initiative.
There's something almost elegant about the whole thing. It's not brute force. It's not technological superiority in the traditional sense. It's patience, commercial cover, compartmentalization, and the exploitation of routine civilian infrastructure. The drones themselves are almost incidental. They're the last link in a chain that's 90% logistics and tradecraft.
That's what I find so compelling about this operation. The technical sophistication isn't in the drone. It's in the organizational design, the network architecture, the patience to move components over months or years, the discipline to maintain cover, the coordination to activate everything in a single window of hours synchronized with a larger military operation. The drone is just the exclamation point at the end of a very long sentence.
The drone is the part that goes boom. The interesting part is everything that came before.
And I think that's the lesson for anyone watching this operation. The future of precision strike isn't just about better missiles or stealthier aircraft. It's about logistics networks that look indistinguishable from civilian commerce, and weapons that can be assembled at the point of use from components that are individually harmless. Distance is dead. Borders are porous. The interior is the front line.
The cost of entry for this kind of operation is dropping. 10 years ago, this was something only a handful of states could pull off. Now the drone technology is commercial. The smuggling infrastructure exists in every sanctioned economy, and the organizational principles are well understood. The barrier isn't technology. It's patience and tradecraft.
Which is its own kind of barrier, to be fair. Patience and tradecraft are harder than technology. Technology you can buy. Patience you have to cultivate. A network you have to build and protect over years. The operational discipline required to run something like this without getting caught is immense.
Yet, apparently, it was done. Or at least that's what both sides are claiming in their own ways.
The Israelis are claiming the operational effect. The Iranians are claiming the post-hoc discovery. Both narratives point to the same reality. Attack drones were assembled and launched from inside Iran, near Tehran, in coordination with a major air campaign. The details will take years to emerge, if they ever do. But the broad strokes are consistent enough to draw conclusions from.
To wrap this back to the prompt's three questions. Smuggling, you move components, not weapons, through legitimate commercial channels over extended periods, using front companies and existing smuggling networks. Concealment, you store components in distributed safe houses, assemble them in a compressed window near the target, and use tight compartmentalization so no single person can compromise the whole network. Activation. You launch from vehicles or rooftops close to the target, timed to the opening of a larger operation, exploiting the fact that short flight times make interception nearly impossible.
That's the framework. And the broader principle is the collapse of distance as a defense enabled by cheap drones and patient logistics. Your country's interior is no longer a sanctuary, it's just another battle space.
Now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
In the 1780s, Polynesian wayfinders accidentally introduced the coconut to the Caribbean coast of Honduras when a storm blew a trading canoe thousands of miles off course, meaning the entire Central American coconut industry may be the result of one very lost navigator.
Coconuts in Honduras are basically shipwrecked castaways that decided to stay.
The most successful accidental colonization in agricultural history. This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com or search for us on Spotify. If you enjoyed this one, leave us a review. It helps.
We'll be back next week. Until then, check your warehouse leases.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.